buonasera. No, c'è bisogno di applausi. Io innanzitutto mi voglio scusare con voi perché oggi farò due parti in commedia. Normalmente io faccio la relazione di apertura e quella di chiusura, invece oggi, come voi sapete, tra pochi minuti arriverà Matthew Weiner, che io considero il massimo sceneggiatore americano vivente oggi. E non volevo lasciare a nessun altro la fortuna di intervistarlo, per cui lo intervisterò io. Matthew Weiner, come sapete, ha contribuito al successo dei Sopranos ed è stato l'ideatore, il creatore, lo sceneggiatore e il regista di Mad Men, serie di enorme successo negli Stati Uniti e nel mondo, esempio quasi di letteratura contemporanea, perché oggi i serial televisivi, quelli più avanzati, sostituiscono anche capolavori di letteratura contemporanea. E quindi è inutile dire quanti awards ha vinto 9 Emmy, ha vinto 3 Golden Globe, è veramente una grande star, tant'è vero che il Time Magazine lo ha messo l'anno scorso nella lista delle 100 persone più influenti al mondo, e la rivista tradizionale del Massachusetts, The Atlantic, che è una specie di New Yorker di Boston, lo ha inserito fra i 21 pensatori coraggiosi dell'anno 2011, insieme a Steve Jobs, insieme a Ai Weiwei, l'artista cinese, e insieme a Terence Malick. Quindi stiamo parlando di qualcuno veramente che ha fatto qualcosa di significativo. A questo punto lo chiamerei sul palco. Matthew Weiner. Did I say the truth?
I didn't have a translation. I had to guess. That it was good.
E gli farò le domande in italiano e lui naturalmente risponderà in inglese, e gli ho chiesto di parlare con una certa lentezza in maniera che tutti possiamo capire, perché lui parla un inglese molto veloce.
Ok.
Allora, Mad Men, enorme successo internazionale. In America ogni puntata è seguita da 12 milioni e mezzo di persone attraverso diversi mezzi, non solamente la televisione, ma la televisione del giorno dopo, il TiVo. Sapete che in America il TiVo vale circa il 30% di quella che è l'audience televisiva. Ha avuto un successo di vendita su iTunes clamoroso, e poi dopo ci sono gli altri strumenti di diffusione. Quindi una serie molto, molto seguita, e soprattutto una serie che ha proprio dettato uno stile per quello che riguarda i serial televisivi, portando un enorme successo alla AMC, che è la rete via cavo che lo ha proposto. Don Draper, il protagonista, dice che non si tratta di attribuirci tutto il merito di attribuire tutto il merito alla sua agenzia, ma due impermeabili su tre, tra quelli venduti lo scorso anno, hanno scritto London Fog nel taschino interno. Ecco, la domanda è: perché ha scelto la pubblicità come elemento narrativo per raccontare quegli anni, considerando che in fondo tutti comprerebbero un impermeabile London Fog con la scritta al proprio nel taschino interno?
Advertising was actually part of it's actually used for a lot of storytelling in American drama, and it was almost a cliche for American culture entertainment of this period, basically from the 40s until about the mid-60s, to have an ad man as the center of the drama. It's a job that in the United States represents great potential for drama because it represents a lot of our values and our conflicts, which are our values being, it's an artistic job, a creative job, which accumulates a lot of money. And there is always a battle in the United States between the artist and the salesman. And we value our artists, but we really, really worship our salesmen. And so that was sort of a form of storytelling at that time, and then it disappeared. It was replaced by the legal drama, the office drama, the Titan of Industry, Dallas, things like that. And so I thought, having worked in network television, when I was looking at the period and interested in the period, I love advertising, and I love the way that these people were sort of venerated in the culture as almost rock stars, and that it was this idealized profession, and that these men lived so hard and were sort of proud of it, like rock stars. And so that became a world that I was interested in, and the television part of it is, as a TV writer, on network television in the United States, it's basically like being, it's a very similar job. There is the writers who are in charge of the creative, and they show up late, and they drink late, and they have very little responsibility on some level, and because it's very hard to force people to be creative. And at the same time, there were the people who were the suits, who were in charge of guiding you towards the public and figuring out how to do the entertainment. And as soon as I saw that dynamic was there, I was like, well, I understand this. And to be able to tell, just for the raincoat part of it, to tell a story about someone asking, who am I? You know, this question, who am I? Which is the fundamental question of Western civilization, maybe all civilization. I love the idea that this man was in charge of representing to the public in a very active dialogue who they were supposed to be.
Se lui si chiedeva chi ero.
Excuse me?
He was asking himself, who am I?
Who am I,
but
yes.
He was two people.
Yes, at least.
How at did least. The idea come of the fact that Don Draper in realtà ha assunto un'identità di un suo compagno morto nella guerra di Corea, se non sbaglio, e quindi
right.
ha avuto
yes.
e quindi c'è questa ombra che lo segue durante tutta la serie, di questa identità rubata da parte di Don Draper. Come
yeah.
nasce questa?
Well, I was interested in telling a story, actually. I started this as a movie. And then I abandoned it. I was writing it for a long time, and I got to about 1960. I was tracing a man's life from the Great Depression in the United States, which is, you know, the 30s, through... It occurred to me that everyone who was in charge in the 20th century had been born during the Great Depression, and that this generation had tremendous impact on us. And they had a lot of things in common, which is that they had these very, most of them came from poverty. Mm-hmm. And when I read their biographies, I discovered that they were filled with a kind of shame about that background. And the interesting thing is this concept of inventing yourself is an American storytelling tradition and a value in many ways. And we don't really ask questions about people's past.
Questo è interessante. That's very interesting.
Yeah, and so I wanted to tell a story about this transformative human being who could shed these layers and become what we see as the ideal person. Because no one is ideal. And the idea that he could construct himself the way Gatsby did in The Great Gatsby. Mm-hmm. That someone would make a lot of money, but they wouldn't have any manners, so they would have to learn how to become a gentleman. And then all of a sudden, there are people showing up who have royal orders and, you know, knighthoods, and they're counts and so forth, and it's all phony. There's actually an expression, you know about, you've heard of Colonel Sanders, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Mm-hmm.
There's an expression called being a Kentucky Colonel, which means it's not a military mm-hmm. thing. It's just someone who is calling themselves a colonel. We are very tolerant of this. And of course, there's a European tradition also of the picaresque hero who sort of pretends to be different people at different time. But that identity question and the guilt that goes along with the murder, basically, and the cowardice of how he gained the identity was part of the was a story. I thought, you look at people, especially older people, and we just sort of assume that they are the way they are and they've always been that way. And of course, everyone has a story and everyone comes from someplace. And I love the idea that this man looked perfect and really was a fugitive.
Lei ha appena detto che Mad Men
yeah.
era stato pensato come un film, poi è diventato una serie televisiva. Ecco.
It wasn't really Mad Men. I didn't know it was going to be. I didn't know it was going to be advertising. I knew I was going to tell a story about this man.
Ah, ok. Qual è, secondo lei, la differenza tra cinema e questi serial televisivi che hanno rivitalizzato la televisione americana negli ultimi anni? Lei ha appena finito di girare un film la scorsa settimana. Come?
Yeah. Yes. They're very different. They're very different. It's like a short story, comparing a short story or a poem to a novel, a play. There are different forms and they have different things that help them tell the story. To me, in my opinion, I look at television because it is the way it was created, live. It used to be live in front of an audience, and even the dramas were shot live even without an audience. It was this great blending, and a lot of the writers came from radio, so mm-hmm. there's a lot of dialogue. And the idea was, how do you blend a play, which is completely dialogue-driven? You know, in a play, someone can't look in their pocket. Mm-hmm. They can't pull something out of their pocket and look at it. They have to take it out and go like that, right? Mm-hmm. And in a movie, you can be right next to somebody, and you can look and see, you know, a phone number written on their hand. So that to me is cinema. And the non-talking parts of the cinema are the parts that speak to me. They have to be set up through dialogue, but I love the idea of not just the big spectacle of an explosion or someone jumping over a wall or breaking out of prison, but also just the moment, I try and do it as much as I can in the TV series, the small moment of, you know, someone leaving money and picking it up, whatever. Mm. You can't do that in a play. So I look at TV as a mixture of drama and theater. And one of the things that really changed with The Sopranos was David Chase said, I'm going to put as much cinema as I can into television. And the reason why we don't put more cinema into television is because it's very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. Very expensive. And when someone is just talking, you and I can talk for 10 minutes, and that costs the same amount to shoot as the first three shots in a car chase. So there's always a joke about how writers don't care about money and that they write in the script, you know, that there's a big love scene and afterward, or a big argument, and afterwards it just says in the script, the Moors attack. You know, the Moros are coming. And that's all they write, because they, you know, go ahead and shoot it, get some horses, get some things, right, you know. Mm-hmm. So David Chase was really like, let's shoot the car chases, let's have people outside, let's go to the places, let's not have them talk on the phone all the time, or if they do talk on the phone, let's see both sides. So for me, that's sort of the blending of the film and TV. What's been most interesting to me economically recently is that the adult drama and the adult comedy, for the most part, are not of interest to Hollywood. And so if you're going to spend $150 million to make a movie, it has to make $1 billion.
Because the cinema audience is young.
I don't think it's just because it's young. I think it's a language issue. I think that the nonverbal comic book style spectacle of like watching a bonfire, mm-hmm. you know, this is not a judgment. Mm-hmm. It's just that the idea that it requires little translation, and in fact everyone can go and see it, And it can work the same in Japan as it does in the United States or in China or wherever. And so this kind of, it's not culturally specific. I mean, I suppose comic books are part of American culture, but it's not, you don't have to be an American to enjoy it. And in fact, you don't even have to be able to read. So that part of the cinema, and this is a long tradition, you know, this is the Great Train Robbery, you know, the silent movies, this was why it became such a gigantic industry. Mm-hmm. But and I personally think that you can tell the story of Hamlet, mm-hmm. and that's around because it's appealing to everyone. But Hollywood, because it's so expensive, they're not making them anymore. So my feeling is the reason why these shows have succeeded on television is because we're meeting a need in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So if you look at when The Sopranos is on the air and look at the best picture for drama, mm-hmm. I think you'll find that The Sopranos was better, or at least equal to it. And the audiences are flocking to it, and because people don't suddenly not have a desire for that kind of entertainment.
Of course. E quindi lei si sarà chiesto mille volte quali sono, a suo vedere, i motivi del successo di Mad Men, ma soprattutto quello che a noi interessa capire è se esistono degli ingredienti comuni tra serial di successo. Lei ha lavorato in due serial di enorme successo, I Sopranos e Mad Men. Se lei dovesse dire in pochi punti a che cosa pensa perché la cosa funzioni.
You have to be very lucky. I would not be. It's hubris to suggest that there is a recipe. Mm. I can say that there are things that they do have in common, which is, and it's funny because there's some talk about the anti-hero, and how that is part of the success of these things. And I don't really view Don as an anti-hero like Tony Soprano. Don doesn't kill people. Don doesn't really rule by force. Don is immoral in many cases, but he is a regular person in many others. I don't think that's the issue. I know that both shows were run by one person and written mostly by one person and sort of guided that way and had very little influence from committee or from marketing or from people trying to guess what the public wanted. They're both very high risk. Mm-hmm. Because there's nothing that sort of exists before them that kind of works that way. I know that both shows have a continuing storyline and have some thematic relevance to the audience. I don't know. I really don't know what...
Each episode doesn't follow the previous one in terms of so precise...
Yeah, I like to have every episode be its own little movie. And I got that from the
Sopranos. So they're a film on their own.
They should be a film on their own. It's about a specific thing. Mm. It has a thematic resonance to it. And it has something that holds the three stories together that makes them go together. Mm. It's not, I mean, I think it is disappointing sometimes to the audience if they're expecting something more traditional, like, okay, at the end of this episode, Don, you know, drops a bomb and yells at somebody. And then the next episode, we never see them again. I think it's, for me, the story was about Don and that person and what it means to dominate a person as opposed to the continuing storyline. The continuing storyline is very important, and I am interested in it, and I try and tell a story that you don't know the ending to, and that does feel like, I mean, every season is a new story, and that can be a discomfort for the audience. And the first episode of the season is usually an answer in some way. I realize this myself. It's not deliberate. To whatever criticism there was about the season before. But, you know, there's always for me, I don't want to repeat myself. And that's been the greatest challenge. And that is also was on The Sopranos also. I mean, I worked in television quite a bit before I got to The Sopranos. And I was just a writer there. It was run by David Chase. It was his vision. And I was there to serve him and to write in his style and to write in a way that he found pleasing and to tell the stories that not only that he thought of, but approved. And I always tried to work in his vernacular. But what it had in common is like he would never, ever, ever think that the audience didn't understand what we were doing. And when you're working in network television or in mass media or on one of these big movies, there's always this anxiety that the audience has no idea what you're talking about, that it's too smart for them or too subtle or not clear enough. And David's philosophy, and I brought this with me to AMC, was if we understand it, the audience will understand it. We're the audience. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get every human being on the planet to watch it. And you don't have to get them to watch it for the same reason. You know, one of the lessons of The Simpsons for me, mm-hmm. you know, The Simpsons, you guys have it here. Okay, this is one of my favorite things in the world is that mm-hmm. cartoon. And I watched it from, you know, I had just met my wife when it came on the air. Mm-hmm. And now I have, you know, 4 children. Yeah, exactly. My oldest is 15. We all watch the show together. And we, like the old Warner Brothers cartoons, like Bugs Bunny, we laugh at different things. There is so much that happens on that show that they do not understand. And not once has one of them said, I don't understand this, and turned off the TV. Mm. Never.
Mm-hmm. That's very, very interesting. Uno dei... Chi studia le serie televisive si accorge che uno dei limiti è che a un certo punto cadono nell'inverosimile. Questo è stato chiamato dai tecnici il fenomeno di jump the shark. Che è riferito a quando Fonzi, lo vedete nell'immagine, in Happy Days.
I don't even like being on the stage with that picture.
Fonzi supera ogni credibilità della serie e salta, fa una gara di salto di uno squalo con lo sci d'acqua. A questo punto lo spettatore si distacca e le serie muoiono. È avvenuto per molte serie, anche probabilmente per serie ancora più famose di Happy Days. Ecco, è possibile, lei ha vigilato su questo aspetto dello jump the shark, e questo è uno dei motivi del successo, che il fatto di non aver mai superato...
This expression is usually about, you know, implausibility, as you say, or a show's premise sort of being taken to the extreme, or being ignored. Mm-hmm. And it comes from, you know, on Happy Days, just to cut them a little bit of slack, as we say. You have that expression?
Yeah.
Basically, to forgive some of this, I would say that they were doing 22 episodes a year for, at that point, I think it was probably 7 or 8 years. I have been doing 13 episodes a year. They're 1 hour long, but 13 episodes a year for 5 years. Mm. So... part of it is fatigue. Hmm. Part of it is there's a line in the show at the beginning of season 3, I think, where Don says, I keep going places and running into and finding out I've already been there. Hmm. And that is the experience of creating the show. And you constantly hear that voice in your head. So you want to keep the continuing storyline and you want to keep it interesting. And I think the most important thing is to ignore the audience. The audience's requests, and they're more vocal than ever through the internet. They used to, you know, Charles Dickens got a few fan letters or something, I'm sure, mm-hmm. but or angry letters. I actually saw a letter at an auction that was written to Scott Fitzgerald, mm-hmm. Which he had written back to someone who had told him that they found The Great Gatsby very disappointing. And they were waiting for it to come out, and it came out, and they were disappointed. And the letter he had written back was an apology saying he was going to try harder in his next book. So I try and tell the story from a place of reality. And I try to use the rules of entertainment as of what's entertaining to me. So a lot of people found, I wouldn't say as a whole, but I had people complain to me that when Don got proposed to Megan at the end of season 4, that this was violated the language of the show. And I find that the audience's rigidity and clinging to the familiar, they crave novelty and they crave the familiar. And you can get completely thrown off course if you listen to them. You have to follow your heart. Mm-hmm. You have to make a show that's entertaining to you. And because I'm dealing in a real universe, it's based on reality. I mean, certainly Don Draper is more exciting than a regular person, and he has a more interesting life than a regular person. And Hitchcock says movies are life with all the boring parts cut out. I don't want it to be boring. But I just try to not to overdo it, not to make it extreme. I was telling you, you know, the first season, Don's on the train in the third episode of the show, and some guy calls him Dick Whitman and knows him from the army. And when we were breaking this story, breaking a story means coming up with the whole story with in the writer's room, I came back from a phone call, and the writer said, "We got it." After this guy says this to Don, Don says, "Let's go get a drink in the bar car." They walk down to the train, and right when they get between the cars, Don pushes him off the train. And I said, "No, Don Draper doesn't kill people. We can't afford to shoot on a real train also." No, I said, "Don Draper doesn't kill people." And if I had done that in episode three, and my show is not The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or these other shows. I do not have a genre. It's one of the toughest things about it. It's a boardroom drama with a family in it. I guess it's a melodrama is the genre, but it's not a Western. It's not a comedy, really. So I don't have any rules to live by. I don't have going against the bad guy. I have to sort of appropriate and take from all the other genres. So I just try and keep it, you know, it becomes a very big story, you know, when Don is even questioned, you know. Small things, insults, slights, you know, being ignored, being treated badly, having a bad conversation, not being close to your wife, having your children be suspicious of you, not having enough money. I mean, these are the problems that we deal with in everyday life, you know, and drama is made out of conflict. It sounds very negative, but it's got to have conflict. And so that's the world that I live in. And it, you know, once in a while, there's something gigantic. This man stole somebody's identity and took their life. And, you know, but when we went back into the past and showed how it happened, what you saw was a teenager who was afraid of getting killed and lit this guy on fire and caused an explosion. And how did he get out of there? All he did was not say a word. Someone else mixed up, you know, he switched dog tags and he didn't say a word. All of it starts to become believable about how a real person would function. And that hopefully keeps you from jumping the shark. I mean, you know, that I've had another element which has helped too, I think, not to go on too long, but which is Don's fear of being exposed has kept him from becoming famous. And that's the big danger in a series like this that's based on real life, is that people become famous. They become known in the world of the show. So if Don were to run for Senate or something, it would make a great story.
That would be jump the shark.
I feel it would be jumping the shark.
Yeah.
Don might work for someone running for Senate. Don might vote for the first time. Don doesn't vote.
Or can do the campaign for Nixon.
They worked on the campaign for Nixon, but we didn't actually have them working on the campaign. I just had them sort of advising the people working on the real campaign so I could use the real stuff.
Talking about John Hamm. John Hamm è l'attore che ha impersonato, che impersona Don Draper. Natalia Aspesi, che è una nostra critica, scrittrice e critica cinematografica, dice che John Hamm è irresistibile. Arriva a dire che qualunque donna lo regalerebbe ad un'amica per la notte di Natale. Ecco, quanto del successo di Mad Men passa attraverso quel volto, quella sigaretta alle 10 del mattino, quello sguardo languido, quelle cravatte sempre imperfette, anche quegli assegni regalati a caso, con gesti di gentilezza, ma proprio casuali.
100% related to the success. In fact, the network that was paying for the pilot did not want him. They did not find him sexy. And he was unknown. He had he had worked on a very little seen television series.
How old was he?
I don't think we're supposed to say that, but the same age as Don.
He was an actor?
He was an actor, and he was in his mid-30s. Mm-hmm. I think he was 35 years old or 33 years old, a little bit younger than Don. And very handsome, the best person that I saw for the role. And I loved the fact that I did not see him before, because I thought, well, when the audience sees him, they're going to think it's him. I was modeling it on The Sopranos. When I watched The Sopranos, I did not know any of those actors, except for Lorraine Bracco, who had been in Goodfellas and had an Oscar nomination, so I knew her. I did not have one of those. And so I worked really hard on finding the right person, and I had a test at the end of the audition for myself, which was the end of the pilot. I don't want to spoil it if you've never seen it, but the end of the pilot, you see Don come home and he's married. And I thought, when I look at this actor, will I hate them when I find out that they're married? And he was the only person who had this wounded sort of internal quality, in addition to the handsomeness and the glamour and the sort of and the ease with speaking. You know, people who look like that can't always talk. You know, they haven't needed to a lot. And so he's very, very, very intelligent, as good actors are. And I fought for him. I basically said I didn't want to do the show if he wasn't going to be on it. And then I learned from The Sopranos and also another show that I wrote on called Becker, which was a situation comedy with Ted Danson, that if the casting is right, the character can get away with a lot. And if someone starts to hate this person or is repelled by them in any way, you're limited what you can do with your behavior. And so I look at him and I see him in the suit and everything and how handsome he is, and that's one thing. Then I see him, his emotions. He has such great access to his emotions. He is very intelligent. He has chemistry with every woman. Usually when you have an actor and you bring in a love interest for them, you do a test, you know. You take a scene and you have them read together. They don't have to kiss or anything, but you have them read in the same room and you see, is there any chemistry? I've never done it. And I had a day the first season. I had a day where he had to kiss Rachel Menken, who was the department store heiress, then Betty Draper, January Jones, his wife, and then there was a third person. I can't remember who it was.
The lover down in the village.
Oh, yes, Midge, exactly. Rosemary DeWitt, in one day. And I came down there, and he said he didn't even put out clothes that day. They just had him in boxer shorts the whole day. And I just came down there, and he was making out with January Jones, and I was like, do you know how much better your job is than mine? But, I mean, he's a real gentleman, and he's a good actor, and it always seems to work out okay. Now I think he's famous, and the women come in, and it can be intimidating. So I need almost a stronger personality with the actress.
Questo è interessante perché lei ci ha detto che, al contrario di quello che avviene nel cinema, lei cercava un attore che non fosse famoso, mentre normalmente al cinema si cercano attori famosi perché garantiscono le audience. Questa è una regola che potremmo dire abbastanza generale nelle serie televisive.
No, not at all. No, they want movie stars all the time. TV shows are, damages.
Sopranos was not like that.
Sopranos was not
Breaking
like that.
Breaking Bad was not like that.
Breaking Bad, Bryan Cranston was a big star in American television.
Okay.
But not internationally. But like, Sopranos was not like that, and it was an exception. And in fact, even David Chase, when he saw my pilot, he said, it's really good, it's too bad you don't have any stars in it. And I was like, but you, that's what you did. And Damages started the same year as us, and it had Glenn Close in it. And the ratings we have now is where that show started. Okay. And I can say, even as an audience member, knowing who somebody is very helpful to me. And a lot of movie stars, it's such a it's a grueling schedule to work on a TV show, but it's only 5 months a year, and you'll never be more famous. And you can get a lot of money if you're coming from the movies. So, but they always want a star. They wanted they want famous names to draw people to the channel. This channel was very unconventional.
I see.
And it's part of, I think, why this happened.
Questo è un convegno organizzato da investitori pubblicitari, e quindi a noi interessa, per esempio, il tema della product placement, del brand investment. Ecco, come l'avete gestito voi? C'è qualche consiglio che lei potrebbe dare
I'd love to talk
renderlo efficace?
Yeah, I believe in product placement. I think no one had a right to do it more than I do on the show. I always am interested, if I can work it into the story, in having it in the show. But I have had, most of the problems that I've had have either been because the network insists on having people buy time on the network, not just buy placement in the show. So the deals are very hard to close. Or they have to agree to my stipulations. These are my stipulations that go with product placement. You can see the pages, but I will have to find a historical angle for your product. You can see what I've written. I will run it by you. I'm not trying to hide it. And I don't want to punch them in the face if they're giving me money. I really don't. You cannot tell anyone that you are in the show. And you cannot advertise while it's on. When the season's over, you can tell everybody you were in it. But you can't, like,
you
say,
use the show.
Yeah, look for the upcoming, in the upcoming episode of Mad Men, Pond's Cold Cream, as seen on Mad Men. You can't do that. And you cannot, a lot of these companies are sponsors that advertise during the show. And if I mention your product in the show, you cannot run an ad in the show. Okay. So when I did Heineken, they wanted to buy 3 minutes of Heineken ads in the middle of the episode, and I was like, that is the dumbest thing in the entire world. That will make the show feel like an ad. Oh, Don was just drinking a Heineken, and here's a Heineken ad. You know, so I find that my own, you have to deal with my philosophy of advertising, which is that I don't want to break the boundaries of the show. I don't want to break that world. On the other hand, I believe in product placement, and I've had a lot of what I consider successful integrations are not always honestly, the agencies are usually the issue. The clients are up for it. The clients know that being mentioned is being mentioned, and that I have a very well-educated and well-to-do audience. So the show has the most – the first season, even though we only had a million people, the average viewer had at least a master's degree – and made over $100,000 a year. That was like 60% of that audience. So that was, we went from having ads for like, you know, a life insurance company that you've never heard of to like Microsoft and BMW in 1 year. And I always want them to, I want the ads to, I want the products to fit into the show. But a lot of times I can't do it. You see, I'm going to use something real. The first year, I'll be very quick about this. The first year, I wanted to do this big story about Pepsi Cola. And they had a great story, and I called them up, and I said, would they be willing to pay to be in it? And they said, absolutely not. We've never heard of your show. We don't like the idea. We don't like the idea that Don's wife is going on modeling, and then we fire her. We're jerks. We don't want to do it. I'm like, well, I'm going to have to use something. And they're like, well, you can't use us. So I put Coca-Cola in there for free, and I get a call from Pepsi every year. And you know, it was you know, Cadillac was in the show, and it's it's an old Cadillac. I don't have to get permission from Cadillac. It was a great story about how Don had arrived when he had this Cadillac, but he cheats on his wife, gets caught, and his wife vomits in that Cadillac. And I know that Cadillac would never let me do that. So I just never called them. I never called them.
Yeah. Did you have problems with it afterwards?
No. They're thrilled.
Oh, they were thrilled.
I mean, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity. It really is true to see your product in the fabric of these people's life, even if it's being, you know, derided in some way. That's what I said to them. I'm going to mention your competitors. When you come in and it's Pond's Cold Cream, you're going to talk about all the different companies that are going against you. You're going to talk about how to sell it, how it's going to seem, you know, whatever. Meanwhile, you're hearing the word Pond's about 20 times in the midst of this movie, and people love that world, and they think, oh my God, the glamour rubs off on it.
Come restando sulla pubblicità, staying on advertising, come hanno misurato il ritorno sull'investimento gli investitori pubblicitari americani su una serie così originale? Che tipo di pubblicità ha attratto? Which kind of advertising has it drawn in?
I could just say financially, the first season of the show, we could all put in a dollar and buy an hour of AMC, of our channel. It was $35,000 for the entire day. And now I think it's, you know, probably $500,000 or $600,000 for 30 seconds during the show. It's only on one, you know, in the premiere episode. We have Microsoft, a lot of brands that have a little bit of that people have been doing sort of retro ads that are from the period. That was my original intention of the show, by the way, was to take old ads and run them in the middle of the show instead of actually making ads. Mm-hmm. And apparently the rights are very complicated for the music and the writing, and the ad agencies were terrified. They hated it. I knew for a fact, because my children listen to old-time radio before they go to bed, and one day my son came down and said, "Dad, I want to buy Kellogg's Pep." And I said, Kellogg's Pep doesn't exist. What is it? And he goes, "No, you can buy it, and it has a ring in it that has a decoder in it, and it gives you Pep. It's a cereal that gives you energy." And I went and listened to this radio show they were listening to from the 1930s, and the advertising had not gone bad. It had not spoiled at all. But that was too complicated. So we have like Canada Dry advertises. BMW was a big sponsor for a long time. Now Chrysler is involved in the show, which then, you know, Fiat and the other companies with Chrysler. They had to add a commercial break to split it in half so that they could have two cars because they can only be in the separate segments. So once I heard that, I knew that the advertising was successful.
Good. Lavorando sulla pubblicità degli anni 50 e 60, sono sicuro che lei si è imbattuto in Jerry della Femina, che era un famoso pubblicitario.
Yes. I actually met him. He told me that there wasn't enough, that there was way more drinking, smoking and sex.
Troppo, too much.
Everyone else has sort of been, the men, I always had the same thing. The men say, "Oh, it wasn't like that." And the women who were there are like, "It was way worse than that." And Jerry was one of the men who came out right away and said, "It's not enough fucking."
È strano perché Jerry della Femina è quello che aveva detto la famosa frase che con la pubblicità l'uomo d'affari americano aveva scoperto la vagina. Davanti ad ogni campagna il suo motto era oggi la terra promessa, oggi la vagina, domani il mondo. È d'accordo con lui quando ha pensato a Mad Men?
I think that's a fascinating slogan. I have tried to sort of show that, you know, that's part of why he succeeded. There is this thing all the time of trying to think like the consumer that I use. The show is not really about advertising to me. In fact, I only use it when it supports the themes in the show. And one of the things is this assumption that you know the consumer and that a human being can know another human being. And right away, early on, Don is constantly saying, like, not just because they put a woman on the account, but saying, like, why are we advertising to men when a woman is going to be buying this? And I think that it's very interesting, and it's the same thing with race in the United States, with blacks and whites. There is just this kind of condescending sort of like ignorance about how to sell something that is not specific enough. And I'm not saying that only women and minorities can sell to women and minorities, but there is the realization that women in particular were the entire marketplace because they were doing all of the shopping and dealing with all the disposable income. And you see it in America, the ads that are on the weekends for men's programming, it's just cars. Mm-hmm. And that's what men are still in control of in the house. Every other product is done during women's programming.
Andremo avanti tutto il pomeriggio perché potremo parlare ancora di tanti argomenti, ma le faccio l'ultima domanda, che è una domanda che interessa a noi italiani. Sure. Secondo lei l'Italia avrebbe opportunità di... c'è dell'Italia da vendere nel mondo? Avrebbe l'Italia opportunità di costruire delle serie televisive che possano essere esportabili nel mondo intero? Se sì, come o quali sono eventualmente gli strumenti che dovrebbero essere utilizzati?
Yes, my God, Italy's contribution to, you know, I don't know. The Renaissance was good. Italy's contribution to world art and entertainment is really a function of how Italy feels about itself. And for those of us in America, we're famous for looking to Europe for guidance. And Shakespeare looked to Italy for his stories.
Certo.
I think that, and I'm an admirer of Italian film, and there's no doubt that still to this day, the most discussed people, the most conversation there is about serious film outside of the United States is always, it's always Fellini, it's always Bertolucci. These people, and you know, Italian cinema in particular, it still has a huge influence. I feel like it has to do with having a confidence about what the story that you're going to tell, having the confidence that, it's a universal story. Mm. And David Chase had this wonderful line in The Sopranos, where they're standing in the Starbucks and they're looking at the espresso machine, and Paulie Walnut says, "We gave the world the gift of our cuisine," right? And I just think that it's our fascination with Italian, with sometimes it's seen as French to some degree, but I think in terms of fashion, food, culture, sex, still you know, that whole standards of beauty all still comes from this country, and it's offered to the entire world. And so those are the stuff of entertainment. And it's not just the opera, you know. So I personally think that you should do what you can to encourage people to come and work here from other places, like Woody Allen or whatever. You know, it has its own natural beauty in it. And I don't know how hard it is for a foreigner to come and work here. Mm. But also to start making entertainment that is a little less escapist. Start dealing with the, you know, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his right name right, but Italo Svevo?
Svevo.
Svevo. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of this man, of the writer. And I always feel like when I read his work, that it's very contemporary and that it's very Italian. And I miss that to me feels more like the United States right now than anything. So I think people should start, you know, if the problem with it is it's expensive. This is not something that you can make at home.
Of course.
But I would think that if Italians were interested in themselves, which they must be, that the world would be interested in them. I know that.
Ringraziamo Matthew Weiner per la sua testimonianza. Grazie mille.
Thank you all for having me.
E lo aspettiamo in Italia a girare una fiction, magari.
Vorrei che i